Good afternoon. Today is Wednesday, May 13th, and this is Adina Laver, your host for a monthly support call on preparing for divorce. And I'm really excited to be with you here today on really an amazing topic that we know is a major concern to families who are considering divorce on paying for college after divorce. This call, as all of our monthly calls are, is sponsored by the Mainline Family Law Center, a mediation firm located in the greater Philadelphia area that really takes a very holistic approach to the divorce process and looks to offer support in all areas, financial, legal, emotional support to help people have a healthy experience through this. And my name is Adina Laver again, and I am the founder of Divorce Essentials, which is a company that is really dedicated to helping people navigate through this process in a healthy way to a positive future. And so people come as they're either considering divorce or thinking about how to navigate, but looking for additional support in terms of emotion and really finding their way through this time. And we come on every month to bring you information and to have a dialogue with a guest who can really share things that help us to be informed, because part of having a healthy divorce is really being as informed as possible, being able to ask the right questions and make wise, discerning choices as you're either considering this transition or navigating it. The way that this call works is our call is a dialogue between myself and a guest, and it's recorded so that you can listen to the information again if you've been on live, or you can get it if you weren't able to be on live. And we really do, though, even though we don't take live questions during the call, we want you to be in touch with us. So we're going to give you lots of information as to how you can follow up with the guest, how you can follow up with Mainline Family Law Center, with myself and Divorce Essentials, so that you can get everything that you really need to be able to make your good choices in moving forward. So today's call is on paying for college after divorce. And who's going to pay for college? How are we going to finance it? And what my experience is no matter what the age of the children are, you know, whether they're newborns or they're, you know, 15, 16 years old, it's still an important, it's an important question for parents they really think about. So we're excited that you're on today, and we're really going to help to give you information that will be useful in this process for you. And I'm thrilled to introduce our guest today, Judy Sciacchi, who is a certified college planning specialist and retirement income certified professional. And she is truly, truly dedicated to helping people avoid the mistakes that she made as she was going through this process. And as founder of APNG Financial and its subsidiary, APNG College Planning, her mission is to help families send their children to the school of their dreams without using all their savings and sacrificing their lifestyle or retirement or going plain broke. So I personally am totally in on this call and hope that you are too. Judy is a member and partner of NACPE, the National Association of College Planning Experts, the leading authority on getting students accepted to their best suited college and getting grants and scholarships regardless of income or assets. APNG and College Planning Experts have helped over 2,500 families gain over $20 million in financial aid. Judy's been featured on KYW, which is a local station here in Philadelphia. She's a member of NICCP, the National Association of Certified College Planners, the National Education Association, the Disciplined Advisor Network, the National Ethics Association, and the Better Business Bureau. And so, Judy, like, you know your stuff. I'm excited to have you on, and welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Ah, thank you for having me. And I'm looking forward to this call. We're planning a ton of information for you, so I hope we can get through it all.
I know. So, like, you know, if I hope everyone's got their 50 minutes really set aside or 45 minutes now, because Judy has so much information. And, you know, Judy, as I said to you when we spoke before this call, is I'm going to play the person who knows nothing here, so I really make sure that the information that you transmit to us is really helps people, regardless of what stage they're in parenting or thinking about college, to really gain the information that they need. And, you know, let's just sort of starting out, I mean, thinking about paying for college is probably, it's hugely anxiety producing. And, you know, just thinking about the amounts of money and the cost of college since, you know, you or I went to college and what it is now, I mean, I don't even know if you have a statistic as to what the exponential growth in the cost of college has been over the last 20 years, but it's enormous, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. To give you an idea, The consumer price index has risen like 115% since 1985, while the cost of college has gone up 500%.
Right, right. And so, and we all know that our salaries have like not gone up 500%, right?
Exactly.
Over that same period of time. You know, so that this idea of paying for college is a whole different ball game than, you know, it even was, as you said, you know, 15 years ago or something like that, or as many people who are on the call, maybe 20 years ago for them or something like that. So this call is really going to be about helping us to make discerning choices. The other thing that makes it complicated, in addition to just like the sheer cost and the magnitude of that, I think is because things do change over time. I mean, we're going to get into it. You and I have talked about, you know, when 529 plans, as an example, first came out, it looked one way and now things change. So things change in the whole funding formulas on college sides. They change in terms of the government. They change in terms of these plans and how important it is to really be up to date and really know how this process works, right?
Well, because it's just so tricky. It's so complicated. It's so convoluted. And I always like to say it's counterintuitive. It does not work the way you think it should. And therein lies the problem. You think you're doing the right thing and it comes back to basically smack you in the face. So what I try to do is help you not have that happen.
So, Judy, we're going to get into like all the details, but maybe one of the things that would be great is for you to share just a little bit about your story and what actually happened to you that makes you so passionate and motivated to be doing this work. So what's your story?
Oh, well, my story is I retired in 2008. I had an actual different business at that point. I ran a very successful media buying company, which is a firm that's responsible for putting all of the ads that you are exposed to every day in front of your face. And I felt very secure in being able to say, oh, it's time, I'm going to retire now. And that was in 2008. Of course, my timing was perfect, if you remember what happened then. And my daughter was going through college right at that point. So I had no money coming in and all this money going out. And I became very angry about what I let happen to my retirement and made it my business to find out what I could do about it. And during that time, I learned two very important things on two ends of the spectrum. One, the importance of having a secure retirement. And the other was the absolutely devastating effect that paying for college can have on your retirement if you don't do it properly. And I learned that I had paid entirely too much for college because I just didn't know the college process. But I certainly know it now, and I became a certified college planning specialist so I could help other people not make the mistakes that I made.
Right. So what happened to you, it sounds like, is that, you know, with your investment portfolio going down because of the crashes that we had in 2008 and the way your money had been structured is you ended up using a lot of retirement money to pay for college and then ended up without the money you needed to retire, and here you are back at work.
Kind of. I'll get into it later, but actually I had saved for college. It was just that I saved in a way that I thought was the right way, and it turned out not to be actually. So, and
so we'll get into that.
Into this call, you will find out about that.
All right, fantastic. So let's begin our journey and start with the very basics. And so the very basics really being, you know, if we have all the money and we can pay, you know, if we're going to private school, $250,000 a year plus, you know, all that kind of stuff, then we're in great shape, whatever, perhaps you're still going to share with us about savings. But for the many of us that don't fall into that situation, perhaps, that many people are going to apply for financial aid. And even if we have saved, we're going to apply for financial aid, perhaps for some reasons. So, you know, what is the difference?
You should always apply for financial. You should always, always fill out the FAFSA, which is
all right.
The
so good. So start here and tell us what the forms are and why we should always do it.
Sure. Okay. There are basically two financial application forms. There's the FAFSA, which is the free application for federal student aid, and that is used by every school in the country. And then there is the CSS profile, which is also required by about 300 of them, of mostly private schools, including all of the elite schools that you think of as the Ivies, and schools like Stanford, Northwestern, Amherst, things of that nature. The important thing when you're divorced is knowing how to fill them out, because they're difficult to fill out in any case because they can be tricky. And when you add divorce into the mix, it becomes a minefield if you don't know what you're doing. And that's the reason
right.
for this call.
that's the reason of this call. So tell us, before we talk, and then we're going to go directly into, you know, if we are considering divorce or we are divorced, how we're going to fill these out. But when you say everybody should be filling out the FAFSA, so why is that? Why should everybody regardless be filling out the FAFSA?
Well, for one, the FAFSA is the form that determines the federal aid for which you will be eligible. And that means anybody who wants to take advantage of student loans, which you're entitled to, you can only get them if you fill out the FAFSA.
Right.
So that's
and the interest rates on the FAFSA and the interest rates on student loans are such that we really, you know, they're a good resource for us.
Yes, they're good loans, and they're much lower than most other loans anywhere, and they're deferred, so that you don't even have to start paying them until after the student graduates college, 6 months after the student graduates college, as a matter of fact. And there's all different ways in which you can actually pay down that debt, and that's a whole other topic. But
right,
but it's important, so you have that option.
Right. So now in the case of divorce, so we were talking about, you know, who fills out these forms. So let's start with the FAFSA first. And why does this make a difference in divorce, who fills it out?
Well, because only the custodial parent fills out the FAFSA, and only the custodial parent's income and assets are reported on the FAFSA. The custodial parent is the parent with whom the child spends the most time over the past year, and that year actually ends on the year up to the date that you fill out that FAFSA. I always say that there's no such thing as, you know, a 50-50 custody, because there's 365 days in the year, and there's going to be one parent with whom the child spends more time than the other. But if you really want to take the 50-50 custody stand, and you really think that you have it even split, the deciding factor will be who paid the most financial support, which may not be the best choice because the lower income earner is eligible for more financial than the higher income earner, and usually the one who gives more higher financial support is the higher income earner. If you are a 50-50, if parents who have 50-50 custody actually have the option to decide who will be the custodial parent.
Right. So in what you're describing to us is that as we go and we sit and we're working out our parenting agreement and our custody agreement, and we're keeping college in mind here, is that because there's federal financial aid available, because it's a great loan to have if there's going to be loans for college, right, it's a great loan to have, that we would want to be strategic in thinking about who becomes the custodial parent for the sake of completing the applications. And so the person who has the lower income may really be. And then, you know, there's all kinds of ways. We're not going to go into the legalities of that because that's really for the attorneys or the mediators. But, you know, and how different ways that income can appear in an agreement and things like that. But certainly this key factor that you've said is that the lower the income of the person completing the application, the greater the eligibility for the financial aid award through FAFSA. And so that would be something we would really want to be mindful about.
Or the CSS profile also.
Okay, or the CSS profile. So, and that there really is a choice. And, you know, one of the things I just want to raise, because I know it can be emotionally tied in, is who has, and custody has legal custody and then custodial custody, right? So, you know, who has legal custody, oftentimes it's both parents. One may have a primary, as you're saying, custody when it comes to the day-to-day. But when we're considering college, this is like we're trying to think separately. So for 50-50, it's not like I'm giving some advantage in terms of my time with my child if I give you the primary custody for the sake of the application. So we're really thinking about how do we situate ourselves best for the system, that we shouldn't get caught up in the emotional part of, well, wait a second, should I be saying that you have primary custody or you have more,
right,
or things like that in terms of the emotionality?
Well, the custodial parent in terms of financial forms, it's not the same thing as legal custody. So you don't have to fear that you're giving up legal custody by not being a custodial parent.
Right. And so, you know, we're giving language here to things that if, whether people are going through mediation or they're having attorneys or whatever it is, they're thinking about it, that, you know, you have the language to really think about, you know, who does it make sense for the purposes of college planning to identify as custodial parent. So, you know, then when we come down, there are some real distinctions. You said both the CSS and the FAFSA, you know, consider who the custodial parent is first and what their income levels. But there are some real differences in these applications as well. So in terms of the FAFSA, it does not consider certain kinds of things that the CSS does. So how do these two applications differ?
Okay, on the FAFSA, you do not report the income or the assets of the non-custodial parent. But any child support or alimony that you receive must be reported on the FAFSA. And you can't, I mean, it is actually even possible to actually change custodial parent from year to year, but be very careful. You may need to prove it. It's a red flag. It may come into play if one of the parents remarries, because if one of the parents remarries, and that's the custodial parent, the step parent's income and assets will be counted, and they'll be counted even if there's a prenup. FAFSA does not care whether or not you have a prenup. If you remarry and you are the custodial parent, your new husband's
or wife's.
Income and assets get counted. On the CSS profile, which is not which is administered by the College Board and not the federal government, it's financially much more invasive. There are more questions asked, and it's not standardized form. They can interpret information differently. On the FAFSA, anything that is given on the FAFSA will be treated the same way by every school that uses the FAFSA and that only uses the FAFSA. The CSS profile is very different because the schools are not standardized in that way. Well, for example, the CSS profile will normally ask for information on both parents. And if both parents are remarried, they can even ask for information on all four parents. When filling out the profile online, your marital status is going to may trigger a non-custodial parent form. And when that happens, you would fill out the information to actually the email that would be used to be able to reach the other parent. You don't fill out any of the actual financial information, the College Board will email the other ex-spouse to get that information. So you don't have to worry about knowing what the information is. Not all CSS profile schools will even require the non-custodial parent form, but I would say don't jump for joy when, you know, if they don't, because they could easily just have their own that they require, and so you need to check the website of the college in question. The problem with that is, even though you don't have to fill it out, is that if your ex-spouse is not willing to be forthcoming with that information and not want to fill it out, that can hold up the admission process. And if that does happen, make sure that you notify the college admissions and the financial aid administrators of that situation.
Okay, so you just gave us a lot of information, so I'm just going to like distill it out here and break it down a little bit. So one of the important things that you said is that child support and alimony is considered as part of the income, so that's going to be part of the custodial parent. If they're the ones receiving it, right. So, and in terms of the custodial parent remarrying, now that as soon as they remarry, that in terms of both applications, it sounds like that step parent or that new spouse's income is considered part of the application as well, that it's going to be asked for. And, you know, you put something in there that said when you might change or not change the status of who the custodial parent. So if we have a couple who, you know, gets a divorce, let's just say for right now that the custodial parent is dad. But then dad's deciding to remarry, future spouse has a significant income. Might that couple decide before they start filling out applications to switch the custodial parent to mom? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, but realize that has to have already taken effect and have been in effect for the year preceding the date that you're filling out the forms.
Okay, so that's really good information to know. So, you know, that's only relevant and applicable either if we're really planning ahead or if the situation really arises that way, that it has to have been in effect and be demonstrable, I assume, you know, in some ways, you know, in some tangible ways, the fact that that change in custody has happened before, you know, for a year before the application is submitted. Okay. One of the things that arose for me that I just realized I didn't get clarification on up front, so I want to make sure that everyone else feels clear too, is what exactly the CSS profile is. So the FAFSA is the federal government, and so it's standardized across all colleges, but the CSS, certain colleges will adopt as an additional form, but then what I think you've said is they can use it however it is they deem to use it. So they may take that application. Do they restructure it, or do they use the information differently?
Well, they actually can interpret the information differently, and they actually can ask supplemental questions to the base form of the profile. And yes, every single school can. They don't all, but some do ask even, you know, more questions than will originally appear, so that the application can become longer and longer depending on how many different schools you apply to. But the purpose of both of those forms is to determine the financial need. The reason on the CSS profile is so much more invasive is it's used primarily by elite private schools. They're the ones who can actually wind up giving you much more money than the other schools, and so they need to know are they right in giving you this money? So that's why it's so much more invasive.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense. You know, then at the end of this piece that we just shared, we started to talk about if there's an ex-spouse who decides that they're unwilling to complete the application. And so, or, you know, a new spouse, like a married spouse who doesn't want to be invaded in that way. So what happens in those cases, and what are the options if, you know, we happen to have got divorced and now my ex is refusing to complete the forms? What happens to my child? What happens to me in those situations?
Well, on the FAFSA, it's not going to be a problem for you if you refuse, because there are no forms for him to fill out. On a CSS profile, as I said, if he does refuse or she refuses to fill it out, I would strongly advise you to contact the schools to which you are applying and notify them of that situation so they know. So it doesn't hold up the application more than for a longer period of time than it has to, which could put the actual application process in jeopardy for going to that school. So that's one route you can take.
Right. And what if, you know, the same would be the case if it's like a married new spouse who suddenly says, well, I don't want to be filling out all these forms, you know. I mean, we got married, but that doesn't mean that for your child from the other marriage, I now want to have to fill out all these forms and things like that, that you would do the same thing?
Yeah, well, that becomes a real problem. That would actually present a real problem, and that I would deal with very specifically. So I don't want to give any general information about that because it's too complicated.
Okay, but that's a situation in which somebody really would want to have a college.
The real thing to do, knowing that if that's coming up and your child is of college age, is to take that into account. Especially if the marriage is coming up, make sure that you know the answer to that question in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And if necessary, I would say to postpone the wedding until after college years, if it's really an important thing to you, or you can make arrangements to be able to change custodial parent.
Mm-hmm. Right. Although it sounds like even if, you know, especially with the CSS, all four parents may be included, or all four adults, I should say, would be included. So I think it's something where you definitely want to seek some additional support, because you don't want to be in the situation of having felt like you've completed all of the forms, you've done everything you were supposed to do, and now suddenly everything's stuck by surprise. So, you know, should you find yourself in those situations where it seems like there might be, you know, challenges in the process for any of these reasons, is, you know, to contact somebody who really can give you additional support around how to navigate in this terrain, because you don't want your child's application to be held up for this reason.
Well, correct. Well, colleges have will and can actually access your tax returns. So mm-hmm. if the information is going to be on the tax returns, they're going to have access to it anyway.
Okay. So I think we're going to move now, like that we've clarified this piece, is how the financial information is actually interpreted. So, you know, what kinds of stuff is collected and how is it interpreted by people on the other side? So walk us through this, Judy.
Okay. The treatment of financial information, as we mentioned before, is a standardized thing on the FAFSA. So it's not a question. They're fairly straightforward questions. Your only problem is knowing how to answer them, because you can put information that is not required that can really really mess up the financial aid to which you actually are eligible. So it's just knowing how to fill out the forms correctly. The difference is what types of questions are asked on the CSS profile as compared to the FAFSA. And they will go, the CSS profile will go into much greater detail on the types of questions. For instance, your residential home is not listed on the FAFSA. It's not considered, but it is on the CSS profile. And there are other things along those lines that will be considered on one by one system of financial aid for an application form, and not the other.
Right. And so ultimately, what they're doing is they're taking all this information here to try to put together a determination as to what you can afford to pay, which is something, you know, the expected family contribution that you would be able to make toward this college, so that they can determine, well, if this is how much you can be expected to pay, then here's how much you may become eligible for, right?
Exactly. Exactly. In other words, it's really based on a formula that goes like this. It's the cost of college. It's the cost of attendance of that college, which includes your tuition, your books, your fees. What a college may actually say is personal expense of the student, which I will tell you is always underestimated. Anyway, all of that is included. So it's the cost of that minus your expected family contribution, which is determined by how the different methodologies assess what you can actually afford to pay for college, and it's based on taking your income and assets and putting a weight against them. Basically, it's kind of like a tax, if you want to look at it that way. Your income is taxed at one rate, your investments are taxed at a different rate. A student's income and assets are assessed at a much higher rate than the parents, and in the case of assets, a much, much higher rate. So you need to know what's considered students' assets compared to what's considered parents' assets, so that you can actually know or what you should do in terms of being able to position yourself better. And here that brings up one point in terms of how one form will interpret a financial asset compared to a different, to one from the other, the CSS profile compared to the FAFSA. Okay, for instance, I always like to say I hate to go into this thing, but it's like the dilemma of the 529 plan. 529 plans were a great concept for saving for college, and that's what they actually do. They allow you to save for college. It's tax advantaged while you save, which you think is, oh, that's great. Not on the federal form, but on your state form usually. And it grows tax deferred. And if you use it for college, you don't pay taxes on the gain. However, in case of the divorce, it becomes very, very tricky, because when two parents are together, that 529 plan is considered an asset of the parent. However, if that 520, when you're divorced, and the 529 plan winds up being owned by the non-custodial parent, and a distribution is made from that 529 plan, Well, that's no longer going to be considered to be an asset of the parent. That's going to be considered a third-party payment. And at that point, that is going to be looked at as untaxed income of the child, which is assessed at 50% on the FAFSA and 100% possibly. And some CSS profile schools or schools that use the CSS profile could look at that as a resource of the child. And that can count as 100%, dollar for dollar reduction in the eligibility for aid for on the following year that distribution is made. So going back to what I was saying about the formula that's used, you've got the cost of attendance minus your EFC equals your need, minus the resources of the student equals your adjusted need. That's the formula. So how it can be affected and really cost you is like this. Let's just say your $20,000 is dispersed from a non-custodial parent-owned 529. And the custodial parent could wind up the following year paying at best $10,000 more for because of that distribution, because it was being assessed at 50% 50% as untaxed income of the child, which is a difference of whether it's counted as 5.64% as an asset of the parent. It's a huge, huge difference. And if it's counted dollar for dollar, that it's actually as though you might as well not have bothered to disperse it because it's giving back the $20,000.
Right. Okay. So I want to just, it's so hugely important to really understand this that, again, I just want to break it down to make sure that all of that becomes clear. So I'm going to repeat it back a little bit, and you just tell me if I'm getting it right. Okay, Judy?
Go.
Okay. That when we complete these applications, that the role of the people interpreting them on the other side is to really determine what our expected family contribution is going to be. How much can we afford to pay? And they've got their ways of figuring that out. But things that are either, so if I'm the custodial parent, my assets are looked at one way on those forms. My, for example, ex-spouse's assets might be looked at in a different way, and then assets that belong directly to my child are looked at in a third way in determining overall how much I can afford to pay, right?
Correct.
So, for example, if, some amount, something that I have in my assets, let's just say I've got a savings plan, a savings account or something that has $20,000 in it. When you say assessed, really what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, is that they would look at that $20,000 and say, we expect that you would contribute 5.6% of that, for example, as the custodial parent, of that particular asset or of all your assets toward the college payment, right?
Basically, you could look at it that way, but it was actually a determination that was fairly recently made, actually, that on the federal forms, that 529 plans and Coverdells would be looked at as an asset of the parent. They weren't always, but now they are.
Right. So those things that are the asset of me as custodial parent are going to be assessed, meaning at this lower rate, that some smaller percentage of that those assets is what I'm expected to pay toward college. But if certain assets, like a 529 plan or something, belong to a third party, like an ex-spouse or something like that, that it would be looked at differently. We expect you to we would assess those perhaps at 50% is what you said, and say that, we expect 50% of that money to go here. And if it's in the child's name, we expect 100% of it to go to college, right?
No, it's not a question of it being in the child's name. Basically, what happens is that asset switches if it's made by a non-custodial parent. The asset actually switches from being the asset of a parent to the asset of the child. And the assets of the child are actually not just an asset of the child. It's looked at as untaxed income of the child,
okay,
which is assessed differently, which is even assessed higher than an asset. It
right.
puts it in a very unattractive light.
So really what we want to make sure we're doing is that we're doing some serious planning around what assets are in whose names before we even begin this process, well before we begin it, to know that we have things divided out in ways that will make us most favorable on these applications, because we can, as you said, in a good faith, do things that we think will be helpful, but by placing them, you know, placing the assets in the wrong place, we could actually work against ourselves here.
That is correct. But you don't realize, if you're not aware of how these things are actually interpreted, you're not aware that you're putting it in the wrong place. And that's
right.
The key. And that's what you have to know before you even, you know, complete your divorce settlement. I mean, that's one thing that should be discussed. Who is going to, what are you going to do with the 529 plan if you have one? There are several different ways you can approach it. You have to see which way is going to be beneficial for your individual case. But there are things that you can do. Some 529 plans allow owners to be changed. That's not true of all of them. They can even be dissolved. The owner can choose to dissolve them. They'll pay a 10% penalty, and plus they'll pay taxes on the gains, but you can actually dissolve them. So if the lower income parent often fears that, you know, that the ex-spouse is going to do that, it actually may not be a bad outcome. It may actually be beneficial. So it all depends on your situation.
Okay, that's good to know. So let's go now into the part. So we're actually in a divorce settlement process, whether we're with mediators or attorneys or whatever we're doing. And some states, you've indicated to me, require that there be a college plan in there, a college funding plan in the divorce agreement. Pennsylvania is not one of those, so there's actually no requirement in Pennsylvania for a parent to pay for a child to go to college, and that's true in many other states as well. So, you know, from a college funding standpoint and the way the colleges look at it, you know, what makes sense to include either, you know, voluntarily in a divorce settlement process? What doesn't it make sense? Because most parents I know, you know, one of the first questions I get is, how can I force the other partner to pay for college or to include college in the settlement agreement? And from what you've told me, that may not even be what we most want to have happen right here. So, you know, tell us about that.
I always think it's a good idea to have a college support agreement, but if at all possible, do not include it as part of the divorce decree or the child support agreement. And that's because colleges can actually can demand to look at your divorce decree to determine the real ability for you to be able to pay for college. They look for those things. So in New Jersey, you may not have that option because in New Jersey, parents are actually required to pay for college. So the ability to actually separate that out from the agreement, you may not have a choice in that matter. But in Pennsylvania, you do.
So what is a college support agreement that is not included? Like what type of an agreement? Is that a contract? How is that created?
Yes, it's another contract, and you would spell out, and in it you would spell out the terms that, you know, who's responsible for what in terms of paying for college. You know, define every single term in there and specify it and make everything as specific as possible. So that you know who's responsible for what and for how long.
Okay, and so that's an agreement that parents can make, or if I'm, you know, want to push for something, that I push to have that separate agreement. And that becomes enforceable under, you know, other contract law, but not under the divorce decree.
Correct.
Okay. And, you know, the reason, if a couple wanted to create one of these agreements, would they do that through their divorce attorneys or mediators, or
yes,
would they do that through some other profession?
No, a divorce attorney will be able to actually tell you that. And yes, the divorce attorney could easily do that if he's an attorney. Contract would be binding anyway. But yes, I mean, you don't need a separate person for that. And it's best to actually know, you know, be able to actually take all of this into account during the divorce process, so that you can have this all settled, and spelled out in one process.
So as we talk about all of this, so I'm going to play like in my head. So you're telling me, right, you know, fill out these forms. I want my income and my assets actually to show, appear in a certain way to make me eligible for the most amount of money that I can get both through the CSS and the FAFSA. So through the school and through the government. And I'm still really worried, like, oh my gosh, what if I get all of this money? Let's just say we do things smartly and we get this money, but we have all these loans. Because I know that there are people, you know, a little like me too, who can just get anxious about having all these loans that are out there. But from a financial standpoint, it may not be the worst thing. So now that we've kind of like gone through a lot of this, like take us back, like what's the reason that we really do want to pursue this, that we maybe shouldn't be scared of these loans, and how this plays into our overall financial picture?
Well, one, it's also can be a philosophical question in terms of do you feel better about having your child have skin in the game in terms of knowing that he actually has to pay for, you know, going through college. Will it, you know, what will be the effect on your child? Will it make him more conscientious and want to be able to actually get that degree in a timely manner? And actually, there are studies that have shown that that actually plays a part. So that's just one thing. The fact that the loans are deferred gives you a chance to be able to develop a plan for being able to pay them off even. You have time to be able to do something in that process. You've got 4 years. So it's something that can actually help you be able to develop a plan to pay for it. You don't have to worry about paying for it all at once.
Hmm. And as you said, there are, you know, there's a lower interest rate on them than there are on other loans, so that if we were going to have to take out loans, or if we would even consider taking money out of retirement to pay, that overall in the long-term picture, the better financial decision would be to go with the lower rated loans.
Yes, but every decision, I mean, every situation is different. You basically have to look at every case individually and see what the best approach is. If you're able to just pay it off, that's not necessarily the best thing to even do, because that's money that's just gone. What can you do to best save for your retirement at the same time? It's all one continuum. That's what you have to look at. How to be able to not just pay for college, but save for your retirement at the same time.
Right, and for other big events that may come up or things
exactly.
Like that. So that's a great perspective, is that we need a holistic financial plan for ourselves, not just be myopically focused on college at the
Correct.
Moment that college comes up. So I think that's great advice. So one other thing I just want to ask you about, because we have a few minutes left here, is that we've heard a huge amount of information from you about paying for college. But in your work, you do more than just help people figure out how to pay for college, because there's a whole other piece of your business that, you know, helps people decide how to make the right match for colleges. So just, you know, tell us a little bit about what the rest of your practice is, because this is just one piece of it. What else do you do?
Part of college success is actually being able to guide the student through the whole maze of actually getting ready to go into college. And there's a whole timeline. It starts so much earlier than people think. Colleges start to look at students actually in, believe it or not, in ninth grade. It's not something that should just be considered about what should I focus my life on. And people think that, oh, I'm a kid, I don't have any interest. It's really not true. You really do. And what we try to do is find out what your passion for learning really is, and what areas really excite you, and what you're going to be interested in, so that we be able to focus your major and know what that is. As you're going through school, not have to worry about not having a clue of what you're going to decide to major in until your senior year, because it's so important. There's a huge study that was just done a few years ago that actually determined it was a great study, because it actually said that college success is based on knowing who you are, knowing what your abilities are, knowing what your passions are. And the earlier you know that, the better. So that's what we try to do for a student. Because if you can discover what your passions are, know what your abilities are, you'll know what major, you'll know what colleges to start focusing on. So we actually guide the student through that, and we help them determine what schools would be the best for them. It's a whole process, and it really works well the longer time that you have. But we've done it in really incredibly short periods of time. But that's the student end, and then we take that student through the whole. We determine whether the student is will perform better on the ACT test as opposed to the SAT test, which will actually put him in a better position for being accepted to college. There's also this thing that most people don't realize. It's called SEM, which is Strategic Enrollment Management, something that's really been developed in the last 20, 25 years. It didn't exist when I went to school, but it's extremely important in being able to position yourself from other students.
Right. So, Judy, since we have just like a couple of minutes left, share with people how they can reach you. And also, I think you have a gift or a resource, actually, that you can point people to that may be helpful. So share with us how people can reach you and what's available.
Okay, they can reach me. My email is Judy@APNG, that stands for Admitted, Pay Less, and Graduate. So it's Judy@APGCollegePlanning.com.
Okay, great. And when they get there, what will they find that would be useful to them?
For today, I've actually compiled a report on what you need to know about college financial aid and paying for college when you're divorced or separated. When you get to my website, you'll see a form on the right-hand page, right on the homepage. It'll say, get our latest report. Just fill that out, send it, and you will receive paying for college after divorce report for this time.
Great. So just give us the website one last time so people can now jot that down. Go ahead.
It's www.apgcollegeplanning.com.
Perfect. Well, Judy, I thank
you
so much.
Yes, but one more thing. And for listening to this call, I'm also offering a half-hour, 30-minute free consultation. And all you have to do is email me. At Judy@APGCollegePlanning.com, and we can set up a time.
Great, and just indicate the support call in the subject line.
Absolutely.
And then Judy will give you a 30-minute consultation.
Exactly.
So I really want to thank you, Judy, for being here. It has been such an incredible wealth of information, and I'm so excited. I know people are going to go to the website to get the information in hard copy form, too. And, you know, please take advantage of that free consult. It will be a great benefit. And if you, in terms of reaching myself or the mediator, the mediation firm can be found at www.mainlinedivorcemediator.com. You've been getting emails through them. You've also been getting emails from me through that, and you will continue to get one following up from this. And for support going through or even considering, is divorce right for me? What will be the impact on my kids, on everything else? You can find me at divorceessentials.net. And please feel free to reach out to us to ask us questions. You have Judy's contact information. You know how to find me. You know how to find the mediators. We're all here to really support you in going forward in a healthy way. So we thank you for joining us here in May. We will be back again in June, so we'll be looking for information soon about that call. And we hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks for joining us.